Hello, Politicos, and welcome to another episode of the Queen's Park Briefing Podcast. To those tuning in, thank you for staying with us during our bit of extended hiatus. My name is Aiden Schmandy. I'm a reporter here at Queen's Park Briefing, and I am joined by
Mike Moffitt, Senior Director of the Smart Prosperity Institute and Assistant Professor at Ivy Business School, Western University.
And a former elite dodgeball player that I just learned.
A lifetime ago at 45, the arms and the knees don't really allow for it anymore. But yes, at one time I could play a little.
Yeah, you know, obviously podcast being, you know, a solely auditory medium. We're on Zoom right now and Mike has two Team Canada jerseys with medals up behind him. So we had a nice fun little conversation before recording about that. I'm sure listeners are absolutely thrilled about this opening. So with Mike on the podcast, I'm sure everyone knows what we're talking about. We're talking housing. There's been a billion housing moves in the last little bit. So just wanted to get Mike on to kind of catch up on all that. And John Tory was nice enough to drop a rather large housing plan recently, which gives us a bit of a news hook here. But the thing that I wanted to start off with is the green belt, because it's probably the most controversial thing that the government has done on the housing file in the last little bit. Now, I'm not going to get into the advance notice stuff because, you know, that's more of a political question. Mike's, you know, primarily a policy guy. But one of the big things from the housing affordability report is that we didn't need to break up the green belt to build the necessary homes, given that you were on the task force. I'm wondering if you could just give us a quick rundown of that kind of finding that argument.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that was there was this argument before this need to build housing that where this was coming from, the sort of housing, you know, need to build more, was this idea that this was actually just all a big backdoor to sort of pave over the green belt. So the housing task force kind of sort of recognized that, you know, that was kind of in the zeitgeist last year. And they said, like, no, you don't need to do that. There's a lot of land, you know, across Ontario that's not in the green belt, and there's a lot we can do to densify that. So the Housing Affordability Task Force made it very, very clear that this isn't necessary. And furthermore, you know, if you look at the amount of land that's getting taken out of the green belt and the type of housing that's likely to go there, which is going to be large, single detached McMansions, largely because, and we kind of know that because that's largely what the builders who own, or the developers that own those plots, that's what they tend to build. You know, you're probably only getting, you know, 30 to 50,000 homes at most, and probably not even that much. So in a province that needs 1.5 million, you know, just say, okay, well, this gets us an extra, you know, 10 or 20 or whatever it is. And you'll note that the government has not come in and said a number, right? Like, if this was going to get us a lot of housing, go, you know, they could make the argument and say, okay, well, yeah, we know this isn't popular, but this is going to get us like 250,000 homes. This is going to get us, you know, 15-20% of the way there. They're not making that argument because you really can't make that argument. There doesn't get us that many homes. It's really not necessary. So the government's getting a lot of pushback on this, and I think rightfully so.
Yeah, I think I've heard Clark say, Steve Clark, Minister of Housing in Ontario, say a couple times that, it, you know, it is 50,000, but we've never really seen that supported by documents or anything like that. Queen's Park Briefing got our hands on a cabinet document when Bill 23 was released, stating that the change to as of right zoning for you know, three units on any lot across Ontario would get about 50,000. But yeah, no kind of official number from the green belt. And I would just say, stay tuned for some FOIs that we've filed. So I kind of want to stick with the theme of the Housing Task Force report a little bit, because lots has changed in the housing space since that report came out. New massive immigration targets. Canada welcomed about 400,000 last year, going up to 500,000 by 2025, spiking interest rates. But we're also seeing things like lumber prices come back down to pre-pandemic levels. Other primary housing inputs are still kind of stubbornly high, unfortunately. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about these developments and kind of how they condition the findings of the report. If it were redone now, like what do these developments do to Ontario's housing crisis today?
Yeah, and I would say all of it together makes it an even bigger challenge. So on the demand side, we have seen immigration targets go up, and they were slated to go up before, but they're now going up at about 30,000 more a year than they were previously. So I think next year we're going to have 450,000, and the previous numbers had been about 420,000. So overall, this is climbing to 500,000. We've also seen some more liberalization of international student rules, and that's a lot of where this demand is coming from, is the international student side. So the federal government has waived rules around how much international students can work in school terms, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually absolutely massive, because international recruiters basically use these policies as ways to attract students to come to Ontario. You know, the sales pitch is basically, come to Ontario, get your diploma, degree, you can work while you're there, it will pay enough to for your housing, for your tuition, and that's not always true, but that's the sales pitch, and you can remit some money back home, and then if you like it in Canada, you can stay and eventually immigrate. So liberalizing these rules. Now, I should point out that the current rules, the current liberalization, the federal government claims for now it's temporary, but I don't think that's affecting the sales pitch. I don't think the recruiters are treating it as temporary. So very, very wonkish stuff. But the idea on both is that we should see our population increase. On the supply side, things are getting more challenging. You know, we are seeing things like lumber prices and other commodities go down, which is good news. But the interest rate spike has slowed development. We're seeing housing starts fall, partly because it's taking some of the demand out of the system, just because first time home buyers can't pass a stress test at a higher interest rate. But those interest rates are also a cost for a lot of the developers, right? Because oftentimes they're having to finance things before they're making sales. So a lot of developers are saying, okay, we're just going to wait a year or two, right? See how all this plays out. We're not going to go out and rush into things. And we've seen this in the province's own forecasts, that they're seeing housing starts fall over the next couple of years, us being at about 80,000 a year or less for the next couple of years. And keep in mind, to hit 1.5 million over 10, we got to be averaging 150, right? And now, you know, the province's own numbers are saying, yeah, we'll be lucky if we get 80. So it's a bigger, bigger challenge. And I think to loop all the way back to the original question, I do think it would have changed the task force recommendation. I think it would have increased a sense of urgency, and it might have raised that actual target to a 1.6 or a 1.7 million.
Yeah, because I remember a little bit ago that big CMHC report came out that was estimating Canada's supply gap and Ontario's supply gap. And I believe it pegged Ontario in the high kind of 1.8. And even this was before some of the moves that we've been talking about. But I see you just wanted to jump in.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, it was actually larger than that. It was a really confusing report, because it was basically saying we need 1.8 over the status quo, and the status quo is about 700,000. So it's actually their numbers is about 2.5 million. Now, we tried, as a Smart Prosperity Institute, we tried to see whether or not that made sense, and we couldn't come up with a demand forecast that was that large. So, you know, we're a little bit, we came to a sort of lower figure. Like we ran the numbers and said, no, actually 1.5 seems reasonable. But it's a good point that there are other estimates out there that are saying, like, no, if anything, 1.5 is too modest, that CMHC and others were saying, you know, higher numbers. And as you point out, all of that was before the immigration changes and the international student changes, which have ramped up population growth. So this is a massive challenge. And I think it's important to put this challenge into context. Again, we're talking about 1.5 million homes, and that's ownership, that's rental, that's apartment units to, you know, basement suites to single detached, all types. We haven't built 750,000 in any 10-year period since 1973 to 1982, 40 years. We haven't. So basically, we have this target that is requiring us to double something that we haven't even done in 40 years. So this is going to be a massive, massive challenge. And I don't think, you know, we're seeing some progress on the policy side, but I don't think any of that comes to that level of the challenge. And to be fair, I think a lot of politicians would be first to admit that, that, yeah, this is the first step and there's more work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just a further note on like the kind of conflicting reports, because I know a lot of people look at this 1.5 number as kind of, you know, the North Star of Ontario housing politics and policy. And, you know, people really look to you for your analysis, but that CMHC report kind of benchmarked 2003, 2004 is the kind of peak affordability era. Yeah. Whereas, you know, Smart Prosperity and the Housing Task Force were looking at, I believe it was kind of 2015 levels.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where, and that's a good point. That's a lot of where the difference sort of comes from, where, you know, we were just kind of looking at, okay, like what, the Housing Affordability Task Force didn't really say where that 1.5 million number came from. It was a bit of a black box. Our number was basically saying, okay, what would it take for Ontario to get up to the current levels of other provinces, right? So the sort of current supply level, keeping into account, you know, differences in population size and differences in population age, because the housing needs of a 65-year-old are different than a 6-year-old, and you need to take these into account. So that's what we were looking at. The CMHC, yeah, absolutely, said, you know, 20 years ago was a golden era for affordability. What would it take to get back there? And that's oftentimes why you get these differences in these reports, is because they're all benchmarking to something different. They're all benchmarking to something goal. So for us, it was just like, okay, how can we have a housing market that looks more like Alberta's? You know, is basically what we were trying to do, where CMHC was essentially creating a time machine and going, okay, how can we create a housing market that looked like 20 years ago?
So I'm really glad you brought up the international student thing, because that is something that I think is often overlooked in discussions around housing. And I was a little afraid that you might kind of preempt my next question and just make it useless, but I think there's still value in asking it. So you mentioned it being easier for international students to work. That's a temporary policy change, but I mean, good luck walking that one back. Where does Ontario's Ministry of Colleges and Universities fit into the fix here? Like, what can that ministry do, either independent of or in conjunction with other housing-focused ministries? What conditions can they put on universities? And just to add another thing onto your plate, you know, Tory's latest housing plan, which we will get to, does mention working with universities to try and get more students housed in some kind of student housing.
Yeah, so the international student side is really interesting, because it works differently than immigration. Immigration, we set a target and we basically know what number we're going to hit across Canada. We say, okay, you know, our target's 400,000, and we can be reasonably sure within, you know, 10,000 either way, we're going to hit that number. And, you know, in part because we only sort of issue so many of these things. International student rules are different in the sense that they download those decisions to the individual colleges and universities. They say, as long as you're meeting a certain set of criteria, you decide how many come in. So it makes planning difficult, because Ontario doesn't know at any point in time, like how many international students are we going to have 2 years from now? We really don't know, because that's a decision made by, you know, Fanshawe College and U of T and, you know, about 35 different institutions, each making these decisions separately. So that creates a bit of a challenge. Now, in theory, the province could cap these, right? Could, you know, the same way that they've, you know, capped tuition, or, you know, capped our salary increases at 1% a year. Not that I'm bitter about that, but that's another podcast for you. In theory, they could cap that. In theory, they could require colleges and universities to build a certain amount of student housing and things like that. They haven't done that. And I think in part, the ability for colleges and universities to bring in international students who often pay 3 to 5 times the amount of tuition of domestic students kind of stops the colleges and universities asking the province for more money, and, you know, helping the colleges and universities fund things like the 10% tuition cut. So we have this thing where it's this kind of implicit agreement where the province does things like holding the line on transfers to colleges and universities, cutting tuitions, which ultimately come out of colleges and universities' pockets, but in return, kind of allow the colleges and universities to do whatever they want on international students. So it's created these planning challenges where municipalities really have no idea how many students that their colleges and universities are going to bring in the next 2 to 3 years. And that creates, you know, not just challenges for housing, but things like transportation and transit and things like that, when you don't know how fast the population is going to grow in particular parts of your city.
I wish I looked up what the definition of a wicked problem was before this, because it kind of sounds like one.
It really is a wicked problem. And like a lot of things in Canadian policy, is basically just kind of a kludge, right? That we want to avoid colleges and universities going bankrupt. We've seen, you know, the issues at Laurentian. So we create these systems that are fairly liberal for schools to bring in students, which again has a lot of benefits, but creates these housing challenges. And one thing I should point out on the university and college side is that it is actually largely become a pathway to immigration, right? That in Canada, we've always had this problem about recognizing foreign credentials. So we bring somebody in who was a doctor in their home country, their credentials don't get recognized here, and they end up driving a cab or working at Pizza Pizza or whatever. We've made the decision as a country about 15 to 20 years ago going, well, instead of having them get their credentials there, why don't they come over at 18 or 19, get a diploma, get a degree. They can now work for 3 years after graduation in Canada under the post-graduation work permit program, and then a permanent residency. So I think it is actually a more sensible way of doing some of our immigration, but it's a wicked problem, as you said, that we don't coordinate all these pieces together, and it creates all of these unintended consequences.
So fun, especially for reporters to dig into. Okay, so on Bill 23, because we started with Greenbelt, we kind of went to, you know, macroeconomic conditions. Bill 23. When it came out, you said it could potentially be a game changer. Do you still feel that way?
I do. Like, I do think the basis of it is solid, right? That it's an interesting bill, because first of all, it touches on about 10 or 12 different acts. It's over 100 pages. And then on top of that, you have other parts of these housing reforms that aren't part of that bill, right? Like the strong mayors and bill, I think it's 39, other areas as well. And I do think there's a lot of good things in there, like being able to build triplexes as of right and some zoning changes. So there are some good things, but there are some problematic ones. I do think the issues around the ability for conservation authorities, you know, limiting their powers, I think is problematic. I know the municipalities, and particularly Mississauga and Mayor Crombie, are really concerned about the changes to development charges. So like any omnibus piece of legislation, there's going to be good parts and bad parts. I do think it changes the landscape. I don't think it goes far enough in many areas. And you and I talked about the Housing Task Force earlier. The Housing Task Force had 55 recommendations, and you can basically break them down almost into a third. A third of which the government is implementing or actively implementing with Bill 23 or some of these other things. A third, they're kind of starting to move in that direction. And a third, they've basically not done at all. So, you know, depending on how generous or greater you want to be, the province has only done about a third to two thirds of what was recommended. So there's still a long way to go on this. And then coupled with the fact that they started adding things in, like the Greenbelt changes, which the Housing Task Force said were counterproductive.
And one thing that we've talked about offline quite a bit is the kind of subtle walkbacks and changes on the development charge moves that they've made. Obviously, Mayor Bonnie Crombie, Mississauga, and like every other mayor in Ontario made a whole hullabaloo about this. Ford then told her to, I don't know if it was stay in her lane. I think that was the Auditor General, but Ford had some choice words for her. So I'm kind of wondering what you make of this subtle walk back on the development charge moves we've seen in the face of this municipal opposition. You know, I'm counting Clark, Steve Clark, saying that he'd make Toronto whole or provide a third of the budget shortfall as a kind of concession. And, you know, obviously the Tories don't have a ton of seats in the 416, have a lot of seats in the 905.
Well, that's just it. Yeah. And so the changes are largely around development charges for affordable housing and certain types of projects where we now charge development charges. And we go, well, you know, the theory of change here is like, do we really want to be taxing those things, right? If we want more affordable housing, more co-op housing, like, why are we charging development charges on those? Which I think is actually a fair question. And I do think had the province done this a different way, where they kind of worked with the municipalities and go, okay, we can all kind of agree this doesn't really make that much sense, but how can we replace that money and sort of come up with a collaborative solution? I do think that there is the basis here for something that makes sense. So, you know, naturally you've got Mayor Crombie and other mayors who have spoken up quite loudly about this and saying, you know, it's going to cost, tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars a year. You know, at first the Ford government said, well, you've got all this money in reserve, why don't you just use that? The municipalities were like, well, it's in reserve for a reason, right? Like, we're planning on using that 2 or 3 years from now for like a water treatment plant or something like that. So there's been all of this sort of back and forth. And the mayors, again, it is mostly coming from the 905 mayors. They start musing things like, well, what we'll do is we'll replace the money through increased property taxes, but we'll actually have a separate line on the tax form that points out how much of this increased tax is because of the Ford changes. And we'll call it like the Ford property tax increase, which you can see why, you know, this Ford and this government would go, okay, well, no, we don't want to be seeing this increasing taxes. So they're trying to find this kind of middle ground. And now they're saying, okay, well, we'll, you know, it wasn't our intent to disrupt your finances, so we'll find a way of making you whole. And that's the term they've used a lot, like making you whole. But nobody's quite sure what that means. And the concern is that, okay, well, they do that for a year or 2 years, but these changes are permanent, right? It's hard, you know, if you're going to replace a permanent revenue stream, you know, in the view of the mayors, and I think rightfully so, you need to replace that with a different permanent revenue stream, not just some form of one-time payment. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out, but I do think we've already seen the government walk this back somewhat, not just in a policy sense, but in a phrasing sense and, you know, being a little less combative about it. So I think this is, you know, this along with the Greenbelt and a few other issues are going to be ones to watch after the holidays, because I don't think these are done yet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And another thing that we will get after the family day holidays, the March break, is the Toronto City staff report back to John Tory on his latest housing plan. So that big housing plan is, you know, getting some folks rather excited. It's definitely more than we've seen from Tory in the past. I have a couple specifics on the plan, but just wondering if you could lay out your broad thoughts before we launch in.
Yeah, so I think this plan, as it stands, is very transformative. You know, just the changes to zoning, being allowed to build, you know, more triplexes by right, and you know, and some of that's in the provincial task force, but the provincial changes have so many caveats to it that they're very limited in their scope. These are far larger in their scope. The provincial government has set this target for the city of Toronto that they need to build, I think it's about 285,000 homes over the next 10 years. I think this would actually get us close to that. The city's going to have to review it and see where the numbers shake out. So I think it's huge. I do think that a lot of this could have been done by the province. you know, that the province itself could have made these changes instead of doing this kind of Rube Goldberg kind of thing, where it's saying, well, no, instead of making the changes ourselves, we want you to do it, you as the mayor of Toronto, but we'll give you more powers. It's this very convoluted way of doing things. And my concern, I think the concern of a lot of housing advocates, is that we're almost feeling like you're now having to decide between, okay, supporting a housing plan and supporting, you know, basically supporting democracy, and, you know, as it's being framed, and that, you know, one member, one vote, that kind of thing. So it's kind of jammed a lot of housing advocates, where we're like, well, we like the housing side, you know, we're a little bit uncomfortable with what you're doing on the changes to the mayoral powers. But again, I think a lot of this was unnecessary. I think that the Ford government could have said, okay, as part of these new housing targets, here are the changes that you need to be made, you need to make. And again, a lot of those changes were in the, you know, a lot of those changes were in the Housing Task Force report. And a lot of what the city of Toronto is doing is the recommendations made a year ago by Ford's own task force.
Yeah, like the politics of downloading responsibility onto municipalities for this problem, when it the province, as you say, could just do it, are very transparent. And I think it was kind of clearly laid out with Doug Ford initially saying that the strong mayor's bill had nothing to do with housing, and then Clark having to come and do a bit of damage control there. But I think that's a little too close to editorializing for my comfort, at least on my part. What do you think this plan means for other municipalities? Like, what kind of cascading effect will this have? Thinking particularly for other GTA municipalities, which are crushed with housing demand, and Ottawa, where new mayor Mark Sutcliffe has said that he won't use the strong mayor or even stronger mayor powers. Yeah,
so the Ottawa situation's interesting. I say this as somebody who owns a home in Ottawa, that our mayor has largely stayed out of the public eye on this fight. He's kind of letting it play out. When the city of Ottawa sent its official plan into the province to be approved, and an official plan, you know, it has things about, you know, zoning and urban growth boundaries and things like that, it came back to the city with a bunch of revisions, basically saying, no, it's not ambitious enough, and you need to extend the urban growth boundary and make these other changes. And the new mayor has basically kind of just shrugged and said, okay, if that's what you want, that's what you want. So he has been absent on this in a way that, again, other mayors haven't. So you've seen Mayor Crombie and Mississauga, who you mentioned, has been vocally against this. You've had other mayors, like my friend Josh Morgan in London, Ontario, who said, okay, well, the province wants us to do 47,000 homes. That's going to take some work, but, you know, let's kind of figure out how we'll do this, and more of a conciliatory approach. So there's a big spectrum of viewpoints across the municipalities. And I think where you're getting the most pushback, I think, is the 905, because those are the ones where you have the biggest challenges, because there are largely a lot of single family homes. And if you look at both like a Mississauga and a Brampton, there's not a lot of greenfield space left. So if you're building, if you're trying to increase the number of net new units, you're basically tearing down smaller apartments and single family homes and building, you know, larger type units, which is naturally somewhat controversial. So I think that's where this fight is going to be. And politically, that's really interesting, because those are the places that decide Ontario elections. So it's going to be this negotiation between Ford and 905 politicians to try and see, OK, can we cool down the temperature a little bit? I know we're 3 years away from an election on both, but I think that's going to go pretty quickly. So we'll have to see where this one lands.
So there are two forces leading me to ask this next question. One is Toronto's housing plan, where Tory not only says he wants to meet the provincial target of, I believe, 286,000 houses over the next year, but, you know, potentially exceed it. The other thing leading me to ask this question is the Tories just don't win seats in the 416, like in downtown core. They have two sweeping majorities And, you know, the NDP is still holding pretty strong to downtown Toronto. So I can't imagine that there's much kind of, there's many seats for the Tories to pick up here. And one thing that I've always been curious about is the extent to which, you know, Toronto really is the root of Ontario's housing woes. Like, if you just let Toronto rip, how much could you get out of it? What would you need to do? And how much would that go towards solving other places' housing crises? And just so I can kind of tie that Ford political thing in, because I don't think it was clear. It's like, housing politics can be a little toxic, but if you're not going to win seats in the place that is most affected, then what is the political incentive not to, you know, go full board with a certain policy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Ford, you know, politics here is really interesting, again, because with him and his brother having spent so much time on council, and in one case, in his brother's case, being mayor, that there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of those conflicts as well, kind of beneath the surface. So, yeah, absolutely. I don't think they're concerned so much about where, you know, how downtown Toronto or what I call the old city of Toronto feels about this, right? That, but for the most part, that's not where the opposition for more density comes from. It's actually more in, ironically enough, places like Etobicoke. And you see Councillor Holliday in Etobicoke being one of the loudest opponents of Tory on this. And I think that's where this fight is ultimately going to be, in the Etobicokes and Scarboroughs and places like that, where the Tories actually do win seats. Now, they could still win a majority without some of those. I think, you know, there is room to, you know, bleed off like a York Southwestern, which I recognize as Ford's nephew. But there, you know, there is some ability there. But yeah, I think in general, this is where the housing demand largely comes from, right? Because this is tends to be the landing point for new Ontarians, whether they be international students or immigrants. They tend to land either in the city of Toronto, in York region or Peel region. So what happens is any lack of housing there tends to spill over to the rest of the province. So if you're, let's say you're Brantford, you know, 80 to 90% of your housing demand is coming from people driving in from the GTA. So it really changes that metric of, you know, how many houses we have to build. Like if Toronto just goes hog wild and builds a lot of homes, that takes so much pressure off of Southwestern Ontario, that your Brantfords, your Woodstocks, your Londons, their demand, you know, absolutely doesn't collapse because they still have international students, they still have some immigration and so on, but it's drastically reduced. So, and it's one of the challenges, again, to doing planning in these communities, is you're not just forecasting immigration and international students, but you're also forecasting how much Toronto is actually going to build and get a sort of act together. So it is a real planning challenge. And again, I think politically the fight isn't so much downtown Toronto, because you're right, it doesn't really matter that much politically, but I also to Ford, but I also don't think it's where the bulk of the opposition is coming from. I think the opposition tends to be more suburban, and a lot of those suburban Toronto seats are part of Ford Nation.
I want to get back to the 1.5 thing, because yeah. Everyone's fixated on that number, but you know, with the provincial housing allocation by municipality and Tory's latest plan, which, as previously mentioned, talks about exceeding those targets, you know, is exceeding or lagging on those targets really a one-for-one trade-off? Like, I guess what I'm kind of trying to get at here is, like, what is the relative ability of an individual dwelling unit in a given municipality to chip away at the overall provincial housing crisis, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, I do think that we do need to look at this as a system. And, you know, if Toronto builds more, that does take some of the pressure off of, say, in Oakville. So I do think that the overall amount matters. Now, I think there is a lack of nuance in that 1.5 million number, because it doesn't take into account, like, okay, are these studio apartments in a condo? Are they, you know, McMansions, or, you know, how affordable are they? Where are they? That kind of thing. So, So I think we need to sort of drill down deeper and have sort of sub targets based on affordability and unit type and things like that, because that's actually caused part of our housing challenges. Not so much that we haven't built enough houses, which we haven't, but what we have built, you can't raise a family in, right? That there are these tiny little 500 and 600 square foot apartments, and you know, nobody wants to have a baby or a toddler running around one of those. So there is challenges there. I think for the most part, again, we've seen municipalities land different places on those targets, you know, and added up, those targets are about 1.2 million because they only cover about 29 different municipalities, and the rest of the provinces is expected to make up to 300,000. We've had some sort of, you know, Toronto seems all in, and then other municipalities have challenged those numbers somewhat. So we'll have to see where that goes. And again, these numbers are already feeling a little bit out of date because they predate the immigration and international student numbers. So I don't expect this discussion on these targets to go away, particularly because the province hasn't yet said what happens if you don't miss your, you know, what happens if you don't hit your target, right? There's no carrots or sticks here. So, and I think at some point the province is going to need to introduce something and say, okay, if you don't hit your target, this is the penalty. So I don't think this issue is going away anytime soon. I think it's going to become more contentious next year.
Yeah. At least the province did kind of like pre-position themselves somewhat on that with that housing pledge in Bill 23 that has no teeth, but Clark said might.
Might someday, and
stay tuned for that, and then you
hear commentators going, okay, well, does the province itself have to sign that pledge to hit the 1.5? So yeah, it's, you know, it feels like you get these stunts sometimes before elections where like taxpayer groups or whatever get politicians or political candidates to sign pledges, and they don't really mean anything other than moral suasion. It feels like that right now, but at some point you would have to come in and go, okay, if you don't do this, then you're going to lose some transit funding or something like that. Or, you know, and you can do it on the carrot side. Okay. Yeah. If you hit these interim targets, we will give you, you know, XYZ. I think there is the ability to do those things, but right now they're completely absent.
Mm-hmm. So you've been very generous with your time. As said from the outset, there's a billion things I want to ask you, but I don't want to go full on Dan Carlin. And as we were discussing before, the France World Cup game is on at 2:00 and it's 1:45. So last thing, you know, we've talked about macro issues, micro issues. Another thing looming over all of this is the Federal Housing Accelerator Fund. It's a big $4 billion fund with scant details announced in the last budget. Trudeau had a meeting with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities just last week, trying to flesh out some details around the program. Clark has mentioned it numerous times as a potential avenue for backfilling some of those municipal budget shortfalls that are coming as a result of the development charge changes. How do you think this fits into the whole issue, and how can it best be utilized? Because the feds clearly don't know what they want to do with it yet.
Yeah, and it has been frustratingly slow to get details, and I'm hoping we have more in the next federal budget, but that's not going to be till March. And we've had a better idea of what this fund won't do. I mean, the province or the federal government has made it clear that this money is not to be used to backfill those missing development charges. You know, they've said that in no uncertain detail, but yeah, I do think it is going to be a bit of a challenge. I think how the money could be best used is basically almost sort of buying reforms, going, okay, here's the kind of thing that we need. And again, if you've got a city where you're allowing threeplexes and fourplexes as of right, and you're wanting to upgrade your computerized approval system to make it go fast, because a lot of this stuff is still done on paper and faxes and, you know, 20 and 30 year old technology. I think that's where the federal government could get the most bang for its buck, by saying, okay, if you meet a certain amount of conditions, you can access this money and use it however you best see fit. But it's an ongoing discussion. And, you know, I think the tension for the federal government is there's going to be this tension between giving somebody something to everybody, right? And just going, okay, we want to be fair to everybody, so we're going to spread this money equally, but also recognizing that our housing challenges are very unequal across the province or across the country, right? Where, you know, Saskatchewan doesn't really have much of a housing crisis, and Southern Ontario has a huge one. So it's like, okay, do you target the money to where it would do the most good, recognizing that that's going to largely keep provinces out? And actually the one place that that type of approach would leave out would be Quebec, and because they tend to have one of the best functioning housing systems in the world. And I think the last thing the federal government wants to do is penalize Quebec for having a relatively affordable housing. This is just a political non-starter. So I think that's causing some of these challenges where Do you want to do the right thing on the economics, or do you want to do the right thing on the politics? And those don't really align too well on this file.
So I think that's probably as good of a place as any to end it. But before I give the official sign off, is there anything else you've been thinking about on housing in the last little bit that you want to get off your chest?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we need to discuss, and this could be a whole other pod for that, is where are we going to find the people to build them? Like, even if we get all of the sort of policy right, where are we going to get the roofers, the plumbers, the electricians? And this is a place where actually immigration could help. And, you know, the federal and provincial government have talked about that. So I think that is a big missing piece of this puzzle that we spend. I'm as guilty of this as anyone. Spend so much time on the regulatory side, but even if you fix all of those problems, we just don't have the people to build those homes. And I think we need to be doing a lot more work there.
Well, the legislature isn't sitting until February 21st, so that's a good time for reporters.
So those MPPs
to potentially
could go
dig into that.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, or those MPPs could go pick up a hammer and go help there. That's actually where I thought you were going with that. They could volunteer some time with Habitat for Humanity or many of our other fantastic nonprofit builders.
There was an absolutely hilarious press conference a couple of days ago where Ford and a couple of the ministers and some MPPs were out celebrating the Shaw family. That's like a woodworking dynasty. And there was one tweet posted with a backbench conservative MPP just hammering, no nail or anything, just hammering like a full-on log. Like, I can't, it's like one of the logs that you use for transmission lines and whatnot. It's just right.
what do you think that's accomplishing? Just smacking around a telephone pole with a hammer. Oh my goodness.
I'm here for people making fools of themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's nothing better than a political photo op gone wrong. That's I live for that stuff.
Okay, Mike. Well, thank you so much for the time. This has been a great podcast. I've really enjoyed this, and I hope the listeners do as well. And as you said, probably five times on this podcast, this is a whole nother topic. This is a topic for another pod. We'll have to have you on again.
There you go. Well, I know you probably got a production schedule to do. So hopefully I've given you some ideas to fill in February, March, and other months as well.
As always, doing my job for me, Mike. Thank you very much.
I do what I can.
Hope you have a good one.
You too. Take care.